For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, author Priti Taneja reimagines King Lear in modern-day India.
There was so much that wasn't talked about to do with India, to do with colonialism, to do with partition of countries and kingdoms and so on at school, but yet there it was in the play.
Narrator David Monteith recalls some of the terrific titles he's turned into talking books.
As the narrator or the reader, you have to be committed to the point of view or the course of action that any character you're reading about is going through at that time.
And we celebrate Valentine's Day with Francesca Segal, author of The Innocence and daughter of the man who wrote Love Story. That's all coming up in today's show. We That Are Young is Priti Taneja's debut novel. Set in modern-day India, the book reimagines the story of King Lear. By turns glitzy and gritty, it blends elements of dynasty and slumdog millionaire to produce a story that drips with Indian tastes and colour. Priti Taneja joined me down the line. What was the hook for you to write the book Reimagining King Lear in modern-day India?
I had a feeling from a very young age that this play encapsulated a lot of what I could see happening in India. I was born and grew up in the UK, and I used to go to India to see my family on my school holidays. And at the same time, I was studying the play at school. And for me, the two things just went together so completely because there was so much that wasn't talked about to do with India, to do with colonialism, to do with partition of countries and kingdoms and so on at school, but yet there it was in the play, and I knew that this was the history of India and the reason why I had been born in the UK. So for me, it just happened very early on that this play somehow was speaking to me of a history that wasn't really discussed anywhere else in the classroom.
Yes, and partition is at the heart of the plot, and Lear is looking to split his kingdom three ways between his daughters, and that is what happened to the Indian subcontinent.
Yes, in 1947, as you mentioned, the subcontinent was partitioned as the British left India, and it was a very traumatic time, huge migration of people along religious lines, between what is now Pakistan into India and vice versa. Many people died on both sides of the religious divide. There was rioting and violence. And those traumatic memories have stayed with people for the last 70 plus years. So it's really important that we begin to think through literature and through testimony how that time impacted us and how it continues to impact us in contemporary politics. And that's really where the book took off for me, looking at that in the present moment.
I found it remarkable how closely you were able to follow the plot and action of King Lear through the novel. It was very recognisable to any of us who've either read the play or seen Sir Ian McKellen recently in the role, and you were able to superimpose modern-day India, Delhi, Kashmir, onto that plot. Did it take a lot of bending into position, or did it fall quite naturally for you?
It really wasn't very difficult. Unfortunately, the world of Lear, which is just so handy-dandy and upside down, and all of these terrible things have been going on, beggars are not taken care of, women trying to survive under patriarchy, mad despots require flattery in public. These are very contemporary concerns as well, and not just in India. So some of the themes, apart from the kind of historical correlations between the division of a kingdom and partition, some of the themes of the play are so human that when you decide to transpose them to a different place, they do slot in very easily. And in India, for me, some of the things that are more difficult perhaps to think through in Western democracies, like having a feudal system with servants, that was easier in India, but that doesn't mean that those things don't exist here in Western democracies. They just are hidden better.
Now, in the book,
your Lear figure is Devraj, who has built a business empire and is wishing to hand it over to his three daughters. Gargi, who is steely and ambitious. Radha, who is rather frivolous. And Sita, who is a Cambridge-educated millennial and very principled, who refuses to play his game of loyalty. One thing that really came through is how women can have power in India, very great power, but only if they play the patrician game.
Yes, there are many women in positions of power in India, and obviously India had a prime minister who was female, Indira Gandhi, for a long time. But women in positions of power often find, no matter which country they're in, that the structure will force them to behave in a way which upholds that very structure. So they almost have to be more brutal. They almost have to be more patrician than the men whose traditional roles they're filling. And I think we can see this in the UK. I'm shocked at Preeti Patel. We have the same name, but we spell it slightly differently. But everything she says is totally the antithesis of what I think should be the case. And you just wonder how you've come of age in the country that can shape you into being that person in a system, in a structure of power that can force you to have these kinds of ideas or shape these ideas in your mind. So Gargi, when she comes of age and she really wants to take over the company, she's got really good intentions. But when she actually steps into her father's shoes, she very quickly becomes like him or even worse than him, potentially, because she just has to be to survive. And I think it's the trick with fiction that you can make people see some of that humanness in her and see the tragedy of how that becomes monstrous, because that's just the way the world makes us unless we fight as hard as we can not to be those people.
Yes, the lines seem laid down. You can either choose to be steely or a flirt, or, well, you better get out of India and go and live in Cambridge, which is what Sita has been doing.
That's true, but there's also these very ancient archetypes in fairy tales and mythology which women are often prescribed with, and you can see these in Grimm as well. Gargi is this crone, Radha is the seductress, and Sita is the saint. So these are the three roles that mythology in Western fairy tales and in Indian mythology are often given. I think in the Indian mythology, there are nuances to this in the Mahabharata or in the Ramayana. These women have very strong personalities. They have a sense of resistance to structures of power. They're often the voice of truth. And yet there's a sense that they have to uphold a certain kind of purity, that they have to be monitored, they have to monitor their behavior. There's no doubt that India is a very dangerous country for women. We've seen that over and over again. Abuse happens in families, it happens in the street, it happens to women walking in society and just trying to make their way in the world. Rape is just so endemic. That is the unfortunate truth. Putting that into fiction makes us reflect on the ways in which we can change those things, respond to those things. These are not easy subjects to talk about, but I think it's important as writers that we step up to do that.
There is brutality in the book, quite shocking brutality, but then you turn on the news and hear that the same thing's happening in real life. How has the book been received in India?
It's mixed. When it first came out here, there was so much attention on it. There was a certain amount of attention that then came on to me because I didn't grow up there, I wasn't born there. So there's this question of, you know, how did you do it? But I've been reading India, visiting India, thinking in Hindi my whole life. So I feel like there's something new emerging where diaspora-born writers who can't be categorized as Indian writers writing in English because we were born in England have to come to terms with that India of their parents' homeland and as it is now, not through these nostalgia glasses. Some people felt like I hadn't gone far enough with the violence in India, whereas in England there was a sense that maybe this wasn't real, that this violence couldn't happen. But as you say, you just turn on the television or read the newspapers or just get engaged in any way in any kind of political life, you can see that this violence is very real. And I feel like it's hard to take home truths, but I do think that Indian literature in India, the things that get published there, the things that readers want and are hungry for, that is changing. They want to see people held to account, society held up to a higher bar in fiction as well as in non-fiction because if journalists, except for a handful of them, are in this role of politicians, and politicians, we can't trust them because of all sorts of ways in which fake news is now able to operate in our lives and ideologies are able to take over politics, then who's left? That is the job of fiction writers and poets.
Certainly you address the anti-corruption protests in the book. The very title, We That Are Young, which is pretty much Edgar's last line in Shakespeare's play, is where the hope comes from.
That's right, and I feel like with Edgar's last lines, they really set us a challenge, because the idea that he's presenting in those lines isn't that he, as a young person, is going to change things for the better. And it isn't that he's learned the lessons of the past. He simply makes a statement that the people who are left, who are young, will never see as much or live as long as those who have gone. What does it really mean? It's a very slippery rhetorical ambivalence that suggests that this is a character who is very good at hedging his bets and doing the right thing for him. And for me, that was just a carte blanche in a way to step off from the end of Lear and take this story into a contemporary moment, into a country facing huge rise of the religious fascists, and start to unpick some of the ways that rhetoric works on us. I mean, you asked me how the book's been received in India, because a lot of it is set in Kashmir, and it kind of predicts or foresees what happened in the summer, where the Indian government swept away a provision in its constitution that protects the special status of Kashmir and links that to an economic argument of development while subjugating the people. Lack of internet access, curfews, violence, which is still ongoing. So the book's been received as some people have gone, wow, that's incredible. Some people have called me a Pakistani agent, which is insane. And others have just said, why didn't you write about your own country? But as a diaspora citizen, that country is the language. It's not one place with national borders or another. Whether or not I'm raising the debate and asking people to examine their own consciences, I don't know if I could claim that, but I think Shakespeare asks us to do that. And that is what the purpose of presenting tragedy on the stage really is. Catharsis is one thing, where we can go away from watching tragedy on the stage and feel like we've cried. Essentially, we just go home to our nice lives and pay £20 for the next performance. But I really don't feel like that's what these plays are meant for, and that's not what the poetry in them is trying to do. I think it's always trying to challenge us to think more deeply about who we are and how we are connected to each other and what that actually means. There's so much fluidity of thought and philosophy in Shakespeare, which I hope that I've brought to We That Are Young, in order to say what's next to the reader. What will you do with all of this information that you now have about the ways that people are all genders, the ways that people can slip between ideologies or manipulate language for their own ends, the ways that we love each other but also want to kill each other? That's all there in the play. It had such a huge effect on me when I was young, because I was looking for rationale linked to a sense of social injustice growing up as an ethnic minority in the UK. That's really where I found my first awakening of politics in literature, I suppose.
Now, it would not have been unlikely that you would have come across Shakespeare had you been educated in India as well, because I understand that Shakespeare is massively popular still and that many of his plays are performed across the country. Is there a reason for that other than that they reflect contemporary society so well?
The primary reason for this spread of Shakespeare is the colonial project to civilise the natives, and I'm putting that in quote marks. Shakespeare was taught to Indian elites to create this class of people who were Indian in blood and colour, but English in taste and morals and sensibilities. It's a cultural colonialism. And yet nobody can control how one mind is going to perceive another. And so once that translation started to happen, people start to, in their own languages, in Bengali poetry and through their own dramatical structures and traditions, begin to add Shakespeare into their own ways of doing theatre, ways of doing poetry, and see as a challenge if they can translate it into their own languages. And once that starts to happen, you cannot control the spread of it. You cannot force someone to learn it as a civilizing mission. And so the spread of it is organic, but it's also got very political origins. And that's very exciting, as theatre became a cinema industry, and Bollywood, as they call it, is one of the biggest cinema industries in the world. Theatre gives way to film, and so Shakespeare leaks into structures of Indian storytelling. So there's a whole history of dissemination which is linked to geopolitical movements, and it's a fascinating one.
Something that really came through in the plot is the sumptuous nature of the food and the fabric. Did you enjoy putting that colour into the book?
I love writing about place, and I love writing about characters as they navigate place. So yes, it was a lot of fun to say, for example, a character like Radha, who's the middle daughter, and she's my favourite character in the novel because she was so much fun to write. She has a really tragic story. She's based on Shakespeare's Regan from King Lear, but you don't have to have understood or read Lear at all to enjoy the book, because she is so much fun, and nobody takes her seriously. She sort of pings between her husband and her father and her lover eventually, but she's got a fine mind and a very witty sense of humour, and she has a secret Twitter account which she is using anonymously to manipulate the share price, and all of the characters in the novel follow this Twitter account and sort of take cues from it and things. So really she's behind the scenes pulling strings just because she's bored of constantly having to be a model. And so, yeah, there's a lot of fun you can have with how she navigates all the different parts of her world. And I was relieved to be able to write that, to be honest.
Yes.
It's a dark play. It's the centre of the canon. And it is tragic and bleak and all of those things. But at the same time, there's hope for love in it. There's hope that these sisters can take each other by the hand.
Well, yes, Cordelia's dying wish is that she can be with her sisters again. Now, blindness plays a large part in King Lear. Can you talk us through how blindness is perceived?
You know, in King Lear, blindness is realised on a character. It's also metaphorical about what we see, what we choose to see, and how blind we are to pain and suffering around us. And one of these things that is so striking about this play is how prescient it can feel. In Kashmir, where the end of the book is set, which acts as the sort of Dover Cliffs of the story, there has been the use of pellet guns by the Indian Army, which have been used to blind civilians to keep the population repressed, basically. And that is an outrageous and tragic example. It's an outrage of dignity, it's an abrogation of human rights, it's a willful, if you like, blinding of people so they can't see the beauty of their own place anymore. They won't be able to work, and all of the things that go with a violently tragic moment. So for me to explore that through the novel, and one of the characters does get blinded, as in Shakespeare's play as well, but he's one of the people who's responsible for gun running so that this horror can take place against the people of Kashmir. Those are interesting parallels and metaphors.
Well, Preeti Taneja, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's not about land. It's about money. He whispers his mantra as the world drops away, swinging like a pendulum around the plane. The glittering ribbon of the Thames, the official stamps of the royal parks, a bald white dome spiked with a yellow crown, are swallowed by summer's deep twilight. The plane lifts, the clouds quilt beneath it, tucking England into bed to dream of better times.
We That Are Young is available from the RNIB Library as TB704094. It's narrated by Sartaj Garawal and Sam Dastor. And Preeti Taneja will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Francesca Segal reflects on the rocky road to romance. But before that, it's always a pleasure to meet the narrators who bring books to life for us. And because RNIB Connect Radio's London studio is in the same building as the Talking Books studio, I get plenty of opportunity. This week, when a familiar voice offered to help me clear up the tea I just spilt, I leapt at the chance to invite David Monteith onto the show. I began by asking him which book he's recording at the moment.
A biography of Keir Hardie.
Any good?
It's very good. It's very interesting. It's always fascinating to read about the history and the founding of the Labour Party, where it came from, a lot about the founding principles and about the man himself.
He had quite a hard life, didn't he?
He did. He was a miner. He was born to a very poor family. I think he was the eldest of five or six, and I'm going back 3 days now, and I can't always remember what I read on Friday. But certainly possibly two of his siblings died when very young. So he was part of a very large family. He recounts a story about being sacked when he worked for a bakery, for a baker's, a very wealthy baker's. And because his father was away looking for work, his father was a ship's carpenter, he was away looking for work. His mother was ill, and so young Keir was the only breadwinner. Because he was working so hard, the weather was dreadful, he turned up late for work, 15 minutes late. He was told by the girl he was working for, under the auspices of this much richer baker, he was told by her that if he was late again, he would be in serious trouble. Unfortunately, the next day he was also 15 minutes late. This was the second day he was late, was his payday. He turned up at work, hoping that everything would be well, was instructed to go and visit the senior employer, the very wealthy man who was sitting at this massive breakfast table with his entire family assembled. Young Keir was soaked to the skin, barefoot, basically rags, you know, the archetypal, stereotypical urchin. He was told that he had brought the bakery into disrepute and that people to whom he was supposed to be delivering were going to leave the bakery because they weren't getting their morning rolls when still hot. So he was sacked. Not only was he sacked, he was fined the previous week's wages. So lost his job, was sent home to an ill mother with nothing but the girl who had chastised him the day before gave him a single roll. He knew of what he spoke when he was founding the Labour Party.
The social injustice really sort of...
Absolutely.
And he worked in the mines as well, didn't he, for a bit?
He did for... Again, it's jumping quite a lot back in the story, and I've gone beyond there, but I think he was in the mines for about 15 years.
Gosh, a hard life as well, but one that led him to become a union representative and led to his political career.
Absolutely. And interestingly, for somebody who was born in Scotland and sort of lived a lot of his life in Scotland, he was an MP in England and in Wales, but never in Scotland.
Oh, how funny. I never realised that. I wonder what he would have thought of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, Keir Hardie was the man who suggested state socialism at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes, indeed. I suspect he would have seen eye to eye with Mr. Corbyn on many things.
He said, treading in middle ground. Well, maybe not appearing at Glastonbury, but...
Well, Keir Hardie certainly appeared at many conferences and events and meetings. I guess part of what he would say is any way you can get the message out and across to people is worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking down the list of talking books that you've narrated for the RNIB Library, and you're quite a one for taking the renegade characters, aren't you? Especially the Scots.
Well, that's just I'm Scots, and that's where I'm from. That's where my accent naturally lends itself to, and that's the nature of the books I'm offered.
Did you enjoy reading? I think it was Renegade by Robin Young, the Robert the Bruce book.
I did. Obviously, that was based on fact. There was a lot of interesting story woven around that to tie lots of things together. But yeah, it's a great book. Massively difficult in one respect, in that before one of the huge battles, there were a huge number. There were, from memory, I think it was about 30 young Scottish noblemen all talking to each other, all discussing the battle, which made the vocal transition from the voiceover point of view made the vocal transition from one character to another, working out who was speaking when it didn't necessarily say, you know, said John, said Robert, said Dugald, made it very complicated. But it was a fantastic read. Great story.
How do you go about preparing that? Do you have coloured markers or?
Yes, I normally read from an iPad, and there's a piece of software called iAnnotate. So I'm usually set, not so much with RNIB books. They tend to be paper, but for commercial books, they are almost always PDF format. I get them and I very simply read the book and then read it again, highlighting dialogue and working out which a colour coding for each character, so that I know when I do a quick glance down the page that the hero is about to turn up. So it's just, it allows me a couple of seconds just to be aware that I'm going to have to do a vocal change.
So in some ways, not only are you the complete cast of actors, but you are also the director as well.
In many respects, yes, because I'm making the decision about how a line comes out. Sometimes it's not necessarily a conscious decision. It just presents itself. You happen to say something with a particular emphasis that you may not even have considered when you were reading it.
And what led you to the RNIB Talking Books Library in the first place?
I was offered a book. It was that simple. I spent years as a commercial voiceover. I do an awful lot of work on film and television. But one of the commercial publishers approached me about doing a book. I happened to end up doing it here. Would I be interested in reading for RNIB? And I said, absolutely, yes, of course.
Quite a lot of tartan noir.
Yes, I do an awful lot of Scottish crime.
I mean, you don't strike me as a particularly threatening man, but do you have a rasping burr to your voice for which you
There
say?
Is a certain pitch I can get to if I really need to.
I'm scared now.
he lied through his teeth.
I recognised that from, I think you did an Inspector Rebus, didn't you? A Question
yes,
of Blood.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's your chilling voice.
Well, it's one of them. It's like, I suppose it's, being a musician. You have certain tunes that you can fall back on that you know are going to be popular. And sometimes you have to just use them to allow the story to roll on, and you get to do maybe slightly more adventurous stuff with incidental characters. It can be very, vocally, very tiring to do too rough and deep and gravelly a voice for an entire book.
Mm.
So my Scots heroes tend to have, as I do, light Glasgow accent, slightly heavier than the one that I normally speak with, because my voice is narrator voice, and then you have what I think of as hero voice, which is or anti-hero voice, which is the one that I go to most easily, the one that I can get to at any point.
I also noticed that you have rather a nice hero in The Nicest Viking.
That was an absolute joy. They were great. I love reading kids' books. I used to read to my own kids before they got to an age where they went, Dad, stop reading to us. It's boring.
And, well, a book that you read that is very real and that I enjoyed dipping in and out of because it was a world I knew nothing about was Song to the Clyde, a history of shipbuilding on the Clyde.
That was quite a personal one. Obviously, growing up in Glasgow, I was very aware of the river, but my grandfather was a naval architect. He designed submarines in the 1930s. So when I saw it sitting on the shelf, I said to Rupert, if when you were considering casting that, you might consider me, I would be eternally grateful.
Oh, it's a wonderful collection of stories and anecdotes and insights into, a world that's gone. I mean, not only are the ships' names forgotten, but so are the names of the people who worked there.
Indeed. And the number of shipyards. I mean, I remember about four names growing up in Glasgow in the 60s and 70s. There were, I mean, obviously more than that. There were yards that weren't the huge commercial yards that we think of today. My grandfather worked in Yarrow's. There were John Brown's. There were a few others dotted about the Clyde. But from the book, I learnt about the literally hundreds, if not thousands, of shipyards that there had been, and not just on the Clyde, which obviously the main river going through Glasgow, but on all the tributary rivers and even the canals, there were bona fide, proper shipyards making narrow boats or canal boats or structures that were then used, transported down those canals to the big major yards. So it's a fascinating process.
And do you often find yourself really engaged with the books that you read?
I think you have to be, because you're trying to express the story, and you always have to remember that it is, generally speaking, it is a story rather than a biography. As the narrator or the reader, you have to be committed to the point of view or the course of action that any character you're reading about is going through at that time. Be that something, wonderful, a celebration, or massive love story or whatever, you have to buy into that with the same degree of enthusiasm as you have to buy into being the murderer in a rebus.
For more information on the magnificent collection of books narrated by David Monteith, search the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. Now, before we return to Pretty Teenager to hear the books of her life, in 1970, Eric Segal's novel Love Story plucked the heartstrings of a generation. He also wrote the screenplay for the film version that followed, and a sequel, Oliver's Story. His daughter, Francesca Segal, is also an accomplished novelist. The Awkward Age is out now commercially.
Julia came down to find both children already in the kitchen, still in pyjamas, still deftly, stubbornly ignoring each other. Nathan stood spooning porridge into his mouth before the open fridge door, staring into its cavern with steady interest, as if watching television. He had not yet styled his hair, which meant a lengthy tenure in the bathroom lay ahead. It stood electrified in thick, dark tufts above his dark brows, and his milky complexion was slightly roughened by excessive, unnecessary, optimistic shaving. Julia had not yet grown accustomed to the boy's minute interest in and attention to his own appearance, which far outstripped her daughter's daily maintenance.
It is a big, big, messy North London family novel, I suppose. It's set at a later stage in life than my first novel. So Julia is the mother of a teenage daughter, Gwen, and lost her husband 5 years ago, but has now found love and potential happiness with James, who has moved in with his teenage children. And it's really the story of how to make two halves of families into a whole. It's the modern family, really. It's sort of trying to make a family with teenage stepchildren, trying to make a relationship when you have responsibilities elsewhere.
The Innocents was very much about first love and a couple who were almost destined to get married. But this is very much rediscovering love then, is it?
If anything, this is very much second love. James is divorced, Julia is widowed, and they found one another probably against the odds, I think it's fair to say. So it's about second chances, really, and about the conflict, really, between personhood and parenthood. Julia's very much trying to find a way to follow her heart, very much against the wishes of her teenage daughter.
So it deals with the love that you choose and the love that is, well, I suppose, almost duty as far as family is concerned.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. It's the tension between romantic, passionate love and the very, very deep responsibility and love that one feels for one's children, which I suppose is, one is often torn between one's spouse and one's children at various points, but that is exacerbated when the spouse or the partner in question isn't a co-parent.
In The Innocents, there was an examination of the love that is expected by the community that Adam and Rachel have grown up in. This reflects a different kind of tension. The children might be pulling you in an opposite direction to the way that your heart would like to go.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think it's Gwen is 15. She's been an only child raised by a single parent for 5 years. They have been very, very intensely dependent and necessarily dependent and close to one another. And all of a sudden, their unit is disrupted by sort of almost a betrayal of her mother by finding love elsewhere. And Gwen is still young enough to feel outraged at the thought of her mother as an independent person with needs beyond those that Gwen can fulfill. And I think probably feels quite betrayed because she has been offering up her needs in a way as a way to occupy her mother and see her through the grief at losing her first husband. And all of a sudden, Julia is happy and happy about something that isn't drawn from the two of them. It's negotiating, I think, that very real dilemma that many people feel in second relationships, trying to, as a second couple, you cannot put yourselves first, but you also mustn't put yourselves last.
Absolutely. And again, I suppose that's the same kind of tension that comes through in The Innocents as well, where there are close communities, whether it's the whole Jewish community in Golders Green, or I suppose the community of the mother and the daughter. Those communities are both supportive and stifling.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Negotiating what the sort of beautiful and supportive and nurturing aspects of those communities or family or the kind of wider, one's wider circle, with the pressure and the expectation and the kind of claustrophobia of those expectations also.
And I know that for The Innocents, you said that you were inspired for the initial scene by reading Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence, but I also felt there was a real sense of sort of Jane Austen type of close community and actually having to face the fact that there are realities outside that community. And it provides a great scope for humour and also for pathos.
Oh God, any sentence that has my name and Jane Austen's in it is a sentence that I treasure, so thank you. Yeah, I hope it's funny. It was certainly, I find humour and pathos in those tensions. I think exploring the absurd is one of the pleasures of, or rather, the absurd is one of the pleasures of those communities, I think, or any community. Living cheek by jowl with any group of people is going to be nurturing and supportive and stifling and probably ridiculous at many points.
And you're clearly a very keen observer. I mean, I love the warts and all portrayal of the whole community, but it's done with a very fond smile, I felt.
I hope so. That was how I intended it. It's, you know, I wanted to write, I suppose, a comedy of manners. And so for that, you are writing, as you say, warts and all. And I don't think there's anything to be embarrassed about writing an honest portrait of a community, particularly because I think, you know, in this instance, it was Jewish North London, but you could very easily substitute in almost any close religious or ethnic or almost any other community, I think, would substitute in quite well, and the tensions and the roles and the dramas would all be the same.
Well, as somebody who grew up in a small village in the Sussex countryside, I can tell you it felt very, very familiar, if with a slightly different reading of the Bible, I suppose.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, well, there you go.
I hope you're not sick of people mentioning it, but you're obviously Eric Siegel's daughter, Eric, who wrote both the screenplay and the novel of Love Story. Did you always know that you were going to be an author? Did it feel like that was being passed down along with your sort of cultural heritage?
I don't remember ever wanting to do anything else. I can't think of a time when I didn't know that this was what I wanted to try and be. I suppose that's the way to put it. I never knew whether I could. One can never depend on finding a publisher or being privileged enough to do it as a career, but it was all I ever wanted. And all I ever really imagined doing was writing stories. It seems to me, I don't know why everyone doesn't think it's the best job in the world.
Oh, it isn't. Hard work, but it, very, very satisfying when it happens.
Yeah.
Did you show your father your work as you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely. I booted him off his typewriter in order to compose quite a great deal of it. So he was forced to read a lot of it. Yeah, no, I did just naturally sort of hand him things. And I mean, my imaginary friend when I was very little was my secretary who took my dictation.
Oh.
So I think, I don't know if it's slightly precocious, but it was just what he did was what I wanted to do, basically.
And you went on to become the reviewer for debut novels for The Observer. Do you think that taught you as much about writing as maybe your father and your reading habits did?
I think it was hugely instructive, and I would urge anybody who aspires to write to just look. I don't know where else one is forced to confront a book mountain like that that shows you just how many debut novels are published in a year. Because there was a period when I was writing that column where most, if not all, debut novels were sent to me over the course of a year. And obviously I wasn't able to read all of them, but I certainly read the first page or the first chapter of all of them. And I would sit, you know, these Santa Claus sacks would arrive, and it was just the weight of them made me very aware that the world didn't need another debut novel, and I had better wait until I really had something to say if I was going to attempt it, certainly if I was going to attempt to publish something. And the other sobering lesson, I suppose, along the same lines was that there were so very, very many debut novels, and, you know, it's now been almost a, you know, more than a decade since I started writing that column, and so few of those names have recurred with a, you know, a second book. I've seen so few second novels from those. Not none, but it was sobering to be reminded that actually it's a very, very hard industry, and probably never harder than now.
This week's theme for the programme is love stories, and I think you wrote a very successful, quirky view on love, the love story in The Innocents, which definitely made me smile and laugh throughout. What do you think the essential ingredients for a good love story are?
I think probably the essential ingredients for a good modern love story are honesty above all, and humour, I think. I think there's a lot of very earnest writing about love, and which can be beautiful and moving, but real life is messy and ridiculous and complicated, and I think maybe those are the things that make something. Recognising that truth might be one of the ingredients that makes love stories moving.
Yeah, showing that the ideal image is a little bit more messy underneath the surface.
Absolutely, and that's okay.
Well, that's actually normal.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
We were talking before we came into the studio about the audiobook versions of The Innocents, and you were telling me that you've been giving pronunciation instructions to the narrator of The Awkward Age.
Yeah, my husband walked in the other night and I was just reciting a strange list of foreign words onto someone's voicemail in California. But she sent me an email, the producer sent me an email saying, you know, there's a lot of Yiddish in your book, and we would just wanted to check the pronunciation. And also, there in America, they're doing this recording, even though the narrator is British. So she wanted to check things like arse. She was very worried about arse. Was it ass or arse? And I suppose I don't realise how much Yiddish I use, although this is a much less Jewish book. But machatonim, which is an amazing Yiddish word for which there is no English translation, which means your child's spouse's parents. That's what they are to you. So the other set of in-laws, basically, are the machatonim. So I was sort of pronouncing all these words onto the producer's voicemail in California, and my husband walked in and said, "Who are you talking to, and what are you talking about?"
And this was 2 o'clock in the morning or something.
Yes, it was. It was
unbelievable.
But yeah, I'm very, very excited about the recording. I absolutely love audiobooks. I think there are certain books that are just lend themselves so beautifully. It's a better way of reading, even if one has all options available.
Do you always have an audiobook on the go?
Always, absolutely always. I get this amazing synesthesia where if I have reached a really climactic moment in a book, in, you know, the vegetable aisle of the supermarket, it will always forever be where that event took place, and they kind of meld together in this really wonderful sort of, yeah, no, I wouldn't be without one.
Oh, fantastic. So there are corners of Waitrose where where people have fallen in love or split up for you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a corner shop in New York that was around the corner from where I used to live, which was where, I don't know if you've read Midnight's Children, but Salim Sanai is held up by the nose by his teacher. And it happened for me in that corner shop. And every time I go there, my blood pressure raises because it's such a high-stakes, sort of ludicrous, terrible scene. But I love that it sort of is like almost overlaid over one's life.
What are you listening to at the moment then?
At the moment, I am re-reading or re-listening to Anna Karenina, and it's actually the LibriVox version.
Oh, right.
I think LibriVox is so brilliant, and all my friends in America seem to know about it, and people here just seem not to have heard of it. I don't know whether that's just the circles that I move in, but I'm absolutely evangelical about LibriVox.
I love the fact that the books are read by volunteers. So, and you can have alternating chapters, you know, somebody in the outback in Australia reading a chapter of Jane Eyre, and then you get somebody from Hong Kong reading the next chapter. It's fantastic.
Yeah, they are brilliant. I have to say, I do sometimes lose my patience with the switching. I've now got narrators that I'm obsessive about following. So Elizabeth Klett, I think, is amazing. And Mill Nicholson, who's on LibriVox and has done, I think I'm right in saying, almost all of Dickens. And she's just fabulous. And there's no changing of voices. And so those two are my absolute favourites. Anything they record, I will listen to.
I think that's something that would chime very much with our listeners who have their favourite narrators for the Talking Books Library.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who will go and search out the next David Thorpe reading, which is fantastic. So, Francesca Segal, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real treat.
Adam had, for the occasion, bought a new suit. He had wavered between dandyish black, chalk-striped and double-breasted, and a more traditional two-button jacket in deep navy wool. After some consideration, he had chosen the navy. It seemed a more appropriate suit for a man who was newly engaged. And now he was in the suit and in synagogue, considering the stained glass windows that painted a dappled light, pale rose and paler sapphire, onto the painted faces in the women's gallery. There were three of these windows, a red-flamed golden candelabra for Hanukkah, a rainbow in a cobalt sky with white-leaded doves swooping beneath its arch, and a third pane in which acid green palm trees framed the two rounded silvery tablets of the Decalogue, an orange and lemon sunburst above them.
Gloria Sanders narrating The Innocents by Francesca Segal, which is TB20539. And The Awkward Age is out now commercially. Have you read a book that you'd like to recommend to the listeners? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing radio@rnib.org.uk. That's radio@rnib.org.uk. Now it's back to Preeti Taneja for the books of her life. So, Preeti, was there a book that you read as a child or a very young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, it was Jane Eyre. I mean, it's a very, very normal question, a standard answer to a very interesting question, but I think a lot of young women would have the same answer. I read Jane Eyre when I was way too young, I was 9, but I fell in love with it straight away. I've really identified with this young woman who is an outsider in her own family and her society and her journey through reading and through becoming educated, which really resonated with my life in a very strange way. And then I was troubled so much by this mad woman in the attic business, and it was only later when I was 14 or 15 that I came to terms with the subterranean colonial commentary that runs through that book. And I realised that I was more like Bertha Mason. And so Jane and Bertha are like twin souls in a way that exist in the novel, and they made me realise what the potential of fiction was to think about women's identity and outsider identities. Charlotte Bronte made me want to be a writer.
While Mr. Rochester and the other gentlemen directed these alterations, the ladies were running up and downstairs ringing for their maids. Mrs. Fairfax was summoned to give information respecting the resources of the house in shawls, dresses, draperies of any kind, and certain wardrobes of the third story were ransacked, and their contents in the shape of brocaded and hooped petticoats, satins, sacks, black modes, lace lappets, etc., were brought down in armfuls by the Abigails. Then a selection was made, and such things as were chosen were carried to the boudoir within the drawing-room. Meantime, Mr. Rochester had again summoned the ladies round him, and was selecting certain of their number to be of his party. "Miss Ingram is mine, of course," said he. Afterwards he named the two Mrs. Eshton, and Mrs. Dent. He looked at me. I happened to be near him, as I had been fastening the clasp of Mrs. Dent's bracelet, which had got loose.
"Will you play?"
he asked. I shook my head. He did not insist, which I rather feared he would have done. He allowed me to return quietly to my usual seat. He and his aides now withdrew behind the curtain. The other party, which was headed by Colonel Dent, sat down on the crescent of chairs. One of the gentlemen, Mr. Eshton, observing me, seemed to propose that I should be asked to join them. But Lady Ingram instantly negatived the notion.
"No," I heard her say, "she looks too stupid for any game of the sort."
Lucy Scott narrating Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, which is TB 14397. Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
The first book that comes to mind would probably be E.M. Forster's first novel, Where Angels Fear to Tread. I love that book because it's a first novel, and if you read all of Forster, you can see the progression from that book to the writer that he was going to become. All of the roots of it are there. It's so beautifully written about this pompous man, Philip, who has to come to terms with his own pomposity through falling in love, and people die on the way. Obviously, it has got elements of tragedy and elements of farce. Got a great sense of place. It's set in Italy. I read it again quite young and read it again so many times. With these rainy day books, I suppose one doesn't always come back to them after a certain age, but until I was in my early 20s, that was my rainy day book.
They were all at Charing Cross to see Lilia off. Philip, Harriet, Irma, Mrs. Herriton herself. Even Mrs. Theobald, squired by Mr. Kingcroft, had braved the journey from Yorkshire to bid her only daughter goodbye. Miss Abbott was likewise attended by numerous relatives. And the sight of so many people talking at once and saying such different things caused Lilia to break into ungovernable peals of laughter. "Quite an ovation!" she cried, sprawling out of her first-class carriage. "They'll take us for royalty. Oh, Mr. Kingcroft, get us foot warmers." The good-natured young man hurried away, and Philip, taking his place, flooded her with a final stream of advice and injunctions. Where to stop, how to learn Italian, when to use mosquito nets, what pictures to look at. "Remember," he concluded, "that it's only by going off the track that you get to know the country. See the little towns, Gubbio, Pienza, Cortona, San Gimignano, Monteriano. And don't, let me beg you, go with that awful tourist idea that Italy's only a museum of antiques and art. Love and understand the Italians, for the people are more marvellous than the land."
Patricia Jones narrating Where Angels Fear to Tread by E.M. Forster, which is TB 8927. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I'm going to rave about this book. It's by a writer called Gina Apostol, and the book is called Insurrecto. It's recently been published by a small press called Fitzcarraldo Editions. And again, it's got two women in it, and they go on this crazy road trip. One is a Filipino translator, and the other one is an American filmmaker. And they go to the Philippines while they're writing a film script about a massacre during the Philippine-American War. And it's just so cleverly structured that you feel the weight of all of this trauma that they're dealing with, but it's hilarious at the same time, and it's intertextual, and it's so lively. If you don't know anything about the Philippines, you'll enjoy it. If you do know about the Philippines, you're going to cry your heart out. I think Gina Apostol is a strange genius, actually. And if you read this book, you will have to go back and read everything else she's ever written.
Magsaline gets the dossier from the filmmaker herself, who emails Magsaline. Microsoft Outlook warns, "Mail thinks this message is junk." Magsaline likes that her mail thinks, but she doubts it. The subject line is intriguing. "Translator needed. Meet me at Muhammad Ali Mall." The message must be from a foreigner. No one in Manila calls the mall by that name.
Some Filipinos do not even know that that seedy building in the traffic hellhole that is Cubao is named for the greatest, Muhammad Ali. Magsaline ignores the message. She is jet-lagged. She has just arrived from New York, on vacation in her birthplace, and she has no time for paid work. She is trying to unwind in Manila, hoping to continue a task that she believes has great spiritual payback, though the rewards are yet to surface. She has begun her mystery novel. She arrives with her baggage, a balikbayan box for her uncles, whose home she is visiting on this trip. The box is packed with vinyl records from bargain bins in a shop on Bleecker Street. Neil Sedaka, Ray Conniff and his singers, the elegies of Karen Carpenter, and, for good measure, a new press of their favorite, Elvis, Aloha from Hawaii, still in cello wrap, plus bottles of Johnny Walker Black Label that she thought might appease them. She has been gone for so long, all wrapped up in bath towels from Marshall's and stuffed with bags of Hershey's Kisses in the extra spaces. Another suitcase filled with books. In her duffel, aubergine with olive handles, a square box covered in pale blue whorls. When Magsaline finally opens the email message, it only repeats its subject line, run on included. Translator needed, meet me at Muhammad Ali Mall, signed. The curtness of it, Magsaline thinks, is rude. She thinks the message is a joke, a hoax drummed up by her writer friends, a bunch of alcoholics hiding out in pork-induced stupor in Flushing, Queens. Not even her mother's phone call had moved her to return home. I cannot go home, Magsaline told her mother a long time ago. Do not come home, her mother had said on the phone. If you feel you cannot do it in the heat, do not return. So she had not.
Insurrecto, by Gina Apostol, is out now as a commercial audiobook narrated by Justine Eyre. Preeti Taneja, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Remember, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, radio@rnib.org.uk. That's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back at the same time next week. We're also available as a podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate or review. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Farewell until next week, and the next chapter of Read On.